Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the Supreme Court of Texas has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Texas Commerce Bank, N.A., and Texas Commerce Equity Holdings, Incorporated versus Linda Grizzle and others from Dallas County and the 5th Appellate District. Excel Corporation versus Jimmy Apodaca from Lubbock County and the 7th Appellate District. And CDN Group Incorporated versus Enrique and Marjorie Delgado from Travis County and the 3rd Appellate District. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We are recording these arguments, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee from the clerk. Justice Hankinson is not sitting in the first call. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Texas Commerce versus Grizzle.
May it please the court, Mr. Gilbreth will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The trial court's summary judgment in this case is fully supported by the exculpatory clause in the Grizzle Trust, and the Court of Appeals erred in holding otherwise. The Grizzle Trust contains a clause limiting the trustee's liability to acts of gross negligence, bad faith, or fraud. Well, the Court of Appeals held that this clause was not a proper basis for summary judgment on the grounds that, one, as a matter of public policy, an exculpatory clause cannot relieve a trustee of liability for self-dealing, and two, evidence of a brief delay in reinvesting trust funds is the mishandling of a trust within the meaning of self-dealing.
Who is the settlor of the trust in this case?
The settlor of the trust in this case, Your Honor, would be the trial court that created the trust on behalf of Brentley Grizzle.
And can that bind Grizzle under the property code?
Yes, Your Honor, it can. In this case, especially where Brentley Grizzle's guardian ad litem signed and approved the trust, her mother signed and approved the trust, and the court did so as well. Now, the Court of Appeals erred because Section 113.059 of the Trust Code specifically authorizes exculpatory clauses like the one in the Grizzle Trust, and it sets forth the only self-dealing exceptions to such clauses. Now, it's undisputed.
I've noticed the respondent cites Bogart on trust.
Yes.
At least the only treatise I'm familiar with on trust. And you don't respond to that. Is it your position the statute just trumps that general rule?
Yes,
Your
Honor. Or
they're wrong that that's not a general rule?
Our response in our reply brief is that, Your Honor, that these principles enunciated by Bogart do not apply because in this case the legislature has authorized the use of exculpatory clauses and has set forth the only two self-dealing exceptions to exculpatory clauses. So these broader principles enunciated by Bogart simply do not apply. The legislature has said which exceptions are necessary and appropriate, and additional exceptions cannot be added by the courts under those circumstances.
What would be bad faith?
Bad faith, Your Honor, is not a precisely defined term in this area of the law. I would suggest then that an appropriate starting place for a definition of bad faith would simply be Black's Law Dictionary. And there, in Black's, it says that the term bad faith is not simply bad judgment or negligence, but rather it implies the conscious doing of a wrong because of dishonest purpose or moral obliquity. They say it is different from the negative idea of negligence in that it contemplates a state of mind affirmatively operating with furtive design or ill will.
This is not really negligence because presumably the banks knew what was going to happen when they did the merger, and maybe they didn't think about it ahead of time, but they could have thought through it and realized that these would be the consequences of the merger. So it's not really an accident or failure to use ordinary care, if you would ordinarily think of it, but it's something to anticipate that this change in business structure is going to cost your customers some money, but I don't know what to call it.
We would say, Your Honor, that if anything, it might rise to the level of negligence. I know that you don't see it that way, but it could possibly be considered bad judgment, which is would still not rise to the level of bad faith. It's certainly not self-dealing. To the extent it's an omission, a failure to consider, in their brief they say that, well, we failed to take into account the adverse tax consequences and market timing. Well, if that's true, then that's simply a mistaken judgment by the trustee, and that's what these exculpatory clauses are designed to protect the trustee from liability for, simply a mistaken judgment. So
neither,
if anything, yeah, I'm
neither,
sorry.
Neither the petitioners or the respondent have discussed restatement on trust section 222, which seems to indicate that there may be, well, we'll use this, the bank, for its own benefit, decides they're going to transfer these assets. And so one bank, they're going to swap. And it's a good business judgment for the bank. But it does impose some sort of cost or generate some sort of profit to the banks to do so that may or may not be at the expense of some of the beneficiaries. The restatement talks in terms of a category that is not bad faith, it's not gross negligence, it's not fraud, but it's a category of dealing where the trustee profits at the expense of the beneficiary and the liability that can otherwise be exculpated is reinstated to the limit of the profit recognized. So there's not a violation of the trustee's duty except to the extent that the trustee has a profit from the activity. But I didn't see anything in the briefs addressing that. So here it was to the business benefit of Texas Commerce Bank and Frost Bank to transfer it. It appears that there's no dispute there was some cost to the trust as a result of this transaction that was not absorbed by the bank. So the bank profits by to that extent. Why isn't this that very narrow issue of what I'd call self-dealing, where the limit of the liability is just to the amount of the expenses imposed upon the trust for having done this?
I think the key to the answer to your question, Your Honor, is when you say self-dealing, and I agree with you, that would be considered a type of self-dealing. And again, we say that when the legislature enacted Section 113.059 and provided two specific self-dealing exceptions, it did not contemplate the addition of any other self-dealing exceptions. So under fundamental principles of statutory construction, the restatement exception that you are referring to would not apply because the legislature has already said, here's what we consider to be necessary and appropriate self-dealing exceptions to a settlor's power to relieve a trustee of liability, and neither one of those apply in this case.
But if the common law, those are exceptions to the duties imposed by common law, as I read the trust code. So you have duties imposed by the common law, and then you have an exception to those duties, responsibilities, and liabilities. But suppose the common law never gave, the common law had a number of things within it that a trustee was not permitted to do. And irrespective of whether the trustee profited from it, it's just something that the trustee just could not do business with itself. And so the statute comes in and says, well, we understand the common law would not permit them to do this, but we're going to say you can under the statute. Does that necessarily exclude a more specific obligation of the common law that prohibited trustees from self-dealing. And you describe this as a function of self-dealing, but couldn't the common law say, we don't allow trustees to deal with themselves with the corpus of the trust, but that's not necessarily where the trustee profits at the expenses of the beneficiary. There's a separate rule that says the trustee can't violate fiduciary duties. I mean, I can't put my interest ahead of my beneficiary's interest. What in the statute would indicate that you can just, the most fundamental responsibility of a fiduciary can be released under the trust agreement, which is a fiduciary no longer has an obligation of a fiduciary?
I think the answer to your question might be twofold, and that is we maintain, again, that the legislature has specified the only self-dealing exception that it believes appropriate. Additionally, the self-dealing, the type of self-dealing that you are referring to is an overly broad, we would submit, concept of self-dealing. The Risser Court, for example, said that the type of conduct you are referring to, where the trustee gains some advantage to the detriment of the trust, would be considered self-dealing. That conception of self-dealing, we would submit, is far too broad, and that true self-dealing consists only of a situation where the trustee is either loaning trust property to himself or selling his property to the trust or purchasing property from the trust. That is true self-dealing and under the common law. And so even if this Section 113.059 would permit a self-dealing exception beyond what the legislature contemplated, it would still be limited in that respect and would not encompass the conduct that we are charged with by the respondents in this case.
The Code of Federal Regulations that was cited has a provision that a bank is free to reorganize these funds, but the bank has to absorb the cost of the reorganization of the fund. In this case, I mean, would there be a claim by the beneficiary against the bank for having passed through some charges, the accounting charges or whatever were incurred, or the losses, the tax consequences as a result of cashing out a fund just so the bank can do this transfer, swapping of banks? Would the CFR provision give the beneficiary the claim against the bank to reimburse those costs?
We do not think so, Your Honor, because in this case, the trust agreement, the Grizzle Trust, specifically permits a trustee to charge reasonable fees. So it would be a question of whether this was a reasonable fee in connection with the merger, and I think that would be a matter within the trustee's judgment, particularly under the exculpatory clause. If somebody were to disagree with the trustee and say, well, we think you're wrong, that that's not an appropriate fee, well, then the exculpatory clause would cover that type of a claim.
What if the bank had sent out notices to people who had trust accounts there and said, in connection with the merger, your account's going to be liquidated and reinvested, and therefore you have a certain period of time to transfer your trust to another branch of the same bank? Would that have killed the merger?
There's no evidence, of course, of that in the record, Your Honor. I do not know the answer to that question because, of course, I wasn't privy to the negotiations and in the merger transaction. I see no indication in the record, though, that that would have killed the merger. I mean, the answer.
Well, I mean, the other side has argued that the bank should have done that and that they didn't because it would have affected the merger and therefore there was benefit to the bank by not notifying customers.
We would disagree with that because this merger, it was not simply a transaction where we wanted their trust accounts in Dallas and they wanted our trust accounts in Corpus Christi. And that was not the purpose of the merger. The merger was a merger between the banks for all purposes, and it was not focused on the trust accounts. So I would say no, that would not have put the kibosh on the merger.
Well, and my understanding is their argument is that should have been done. If that had been done, they would not have suffered this loss.
Yes, they take that position that that should have been done. I don't know that they can follow through and say they wouldn't have suffered this loss, but they contend that we should have given them notice. And again, we would say that the exculpatory clause, if anything, that would rise to the level of a mistaken judgment not doing that, and that the exculpatory clause would cover any claims based on that assertion. It doesn't rise to the level of gross negligence, bad faith, or fraud, and there's no summary judgment evidence in the record to suggest or to support a claim for gross negligence, bad faith, or fraud.
Is there any connection between the issue involving the tender and the DTPA and the bank's position that they caused no damage or not liable for any when they tendered an amount that was requested, including the attorney's fee?
Not directly, Your Honor. I mean, the causation argument and the DTPA tender, I would say, are not linked. The causation argument is that she didn't suffer a loss because at the time of the merger, she had about $195,000 worth of investments. After the merger and after the liquidation, she had about the exact amount of cash, $195,000 in cash.
Well, but that's not really their claim. The claim is their, what you did caused tax consequences, which in turn gave them tax liabilities and other causes.
That's their contention. We would disagree, Your Honor, that the tax loss is damages. I mean, we would contend that it's actually a benefit that the trustee...
Well, I presume your viewpoint about the settlement tender was one to at least avoid the consequences of a DTPA cause of action, other than instead of admitting liability on the trust claim.
The tender, Your Honor, was... just one basis for negating the DTPA claim. We also attempted to and did negate the DTPA claim through the exculpatory clause. The tender was simply an alternative basis, and we were not attempting to avoid the merits of the DTPA claim, and we put on summary judgment evidence that there were no misrepresentations and no reliance as well, and no damages. So we attacked all of the claims on the merits. The tender was just simply an additional basis to avoid the claim.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Northrup.
Mr. Northrup, I have a question I wanted to follow up on, a question was asked earlier. You, in the briefing, you make the point that had your client been advised of this intended bank swap, the client would have had the opportunity to move the trust to a different branch of the bank, ostensibly avoiding the realization of the tax consequence or the recognition of the tax consequence, but there wasn't a response to it, and it's not clear to me if, in fact, that was available from the record. So, I mean, did you establish that you could have avoided the tax consequence by simply moving it to a Frost Bank in San Antonio as opposed to the Frost Bank in Dallas?
Your Honor, actually, there isn't any evidence that that could have been done, except from our expert, James Bevins, whose affidavit is part of the record, and he indicated that that was an option that was available. He is a vice president, a former vice president of the Trust Department of Nations Bank. And that is very frequently something that is done with respect to trusts when there are mergers or buyout agreements such as the one in this case. That was not available to our clients. It was never an option that was provided to our clients, and that is the essence of our complaint, is that that option should have been given to them. And our belief is that it was not provided to them because it would have undermined this bank swap. The consideration on both sides of this transaction, the parts of it that were roughly equal were the amount of fees that were being generated by the trust departments. And to say that the trust departments didn't enter into that transaction, I think ignores the truth of what this transaction was about. The banks were swapping, basically it was an even trade, swapping branches. And if the beneficiaries or various trusts in that trust department had walked down the street and gone to another branch, then it would have undermined the transaction, and it might not have gone through.
You also make a reference to the Code of Federal Regulations at volume 12 or whatever it is, in section 9.18, that talks about cost reorganizing a fund. Does the record demonstrate that accounting fees or whatever are those types of funds that are supposed to be absorbed by the banks when they do this?
I believe, Your Honor, that those are funds that are to be absorbed by the banks, and our contention is that it was wrong to pass them along to the beneficiaries of these trusts. They would not have been incurred had this transaction not occurred. The Office of the Comptroller of Currency, which is the regulating authority for federally insured banks, has described a bank's investment in proprietary funds as one that gives rise to a conflict of interest. And this is something that is not cited in our briefs. It's available on Westlaw, and I'll give the court the Westlaw site on it. It comes out of the Comptroller's Handbook for Asset Management and is part of Appendix E of the Examiner's Handbook, and it's at 2000 Westlaw, 914097. In that particular publication, they have described the investment in a bank's proprietary funds as giving rise to a conflict of interest. I believe that's why Title 12 CFR 9.18 is required, so that it authorizes a bank to go ahead and invest in that. However, in spite of that, the bank isn't allowed to go forward and still put its interests above the beneficiary's interests, which is precisely what occurred in this particular instance. This was not an ordinary
transaction. You say it's not allowed to do that by what?
It is not allowed to do that, and let me respond to your question, Justice Heck, by responding to the argument that has been made by the banks. The banks have argued that Section 9.18 required them to divest the proprietary funds of the predecessor bank. In fact, if you look at that section, it doesn't say anything about a bank being able to hold another bank's proprietary funds. In fact, it doesn't prohibit that at all. All it does is it authorizes a bank to purchase its own proprietary funds. But let me point you to another publication of the Office of the Comptroller of Currency, and I'll give you the Westlaw site on that because it's also not cited in our brief.
What sort of deference do we have to give to that?
As the regulating authority, I believe this court has to give deference to that authority's interpretation of its own regulation.
Is there a case that says that?
I do not have one with me, Your Honor. This citation is also part of the Handbook for Examiners, and it's at 1994 Westlaw 59811. In that publication, it indicates that the examiner, a bank examiner, has the authority, based upon a fund-by-fund basis, to make exceptions and make determinations with respect to whether a bank should retain a fund or invest in another fund, including proprietary funds. And I submit to you that that was one option that these banks had in this case, was to request the examiner to authorize them to maintain those funds of the predecessor bank.
Is there any evidence or authority that is usually done in these kinds of things?
There is no evidence of that is usually done.
More authority?
The authority that we have and that we would rely upon is that in the affidavit of James Bevins, which is in the record and is part of our motion for summary judgment.
Does it support this argument?
I believe it does. I don't have it in front of me, but my recollection is that that was one thing that he indicated was an option, certainly, in addition to the option of giving the beneficiaries the right to go down the street and go to another branch of the same overall bank.
Let me ask you some questions about your damages.
You have three elements, I believe, actual damages. And the first is the tax loss. Is that correct?
Yes.
This is for the individual.
Yes.
And there was a gain, but that was offset against that, was there not?
I believe in the record there is an indication that that was offset by the gain, at least in Linda Grizzle's case. In other class members' cases, there were losses. In Marilyn Rucker's case, I believe there was a gain that was never fully, or a loss, I guess, that was never fully able to be written off before she passed away. So she was never able to take full, advantage to the extent that that is an advantage.
In the second of these fees, which you say the comptroller's handled,
yes,
should not have been charged. And the third is a failure to reinvest the money for 42 days.
Yes.
Now, surely there are instances when just putting the money under a mattress might be the best thing to do, or at least better than investing it in
I will concede, Chief Justice Phillips, that there are instances where parking it in some non-interest drawing account might be appropriate. If the court looks at the case of the Risser case, which is cited in our briefs, that court seems to indicate that a fiduciary putting money into a non-interest bearing account is a violation of the fiduciary responsibility.
Even for a day?
I don't think for a day. And let me just say,
where's the cutoff?
Well, I don't know that there is a bright line test on that. And let me say this about the Risser case. The Court of Appeals in our case cited Risser for that proposition. Our opinion on that particular proposition is that the Court of Appeals may very well have gotten that interpretation of Risser wrong. What the court was talking about in Risser in addressing that was an allegation that was made by the parties. And the court then goes on to address that allegation jointly with other allegations and never individually singles it out as a violation of the fiduciary duty. But we are not saying in our case, and this is where the Court of Appeals below, I think, misinterpreted our position, we are not saying that the failure to invest funds in and of itself is a breach of fiduciary duty. We are saying that this is a consequential damage that would not have happened but for the fact that the banks liquidated those funds and then parked them for months in some cases in very low interest drawing accounts at a time when the market was doing very well and as a result our clients missed out on some wonderful market opportunities.
Now, let me ask, consequential damage, are you taking Dell computer stuff and comparing that against where the money was parked for months?
Not being a damage expert, I guess I would say that analysis probably needs to be undertaken. I'm not sure how well it would be or how easy it would be to measure that. I think what would need to be done is not to look at Dell stock, but look at the proprietary funds that the money should have been put in, compare that performance to where the money was parked for those months, and take the difference from that.
The scope, I have a little bit of difficulty with an exculpatory clause that says investment decisions are not going to be a basis for bringing a claim back against, except for bad faith or negligence, or gross negligence or fraud. My difficulty with the RISR, it seems to say that you, in this case where they parked it, and perhaps you're arguing you should have gotten a better interest rate than the interest rate here, when you allow that to be a recovery for damages, how can you still have a viable exculpatory clause for investments? What is the element that makes the bad investment outside of the exculpatory clause and inside a breach of fiduciary duty without eviscerating the exculpatory clause entirely?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Justice Enoch, but I'll try to answer it.
Let me rephrase it.
Okay.
I'll try and rephrase it. The argument of the banks are, we made a bad decision. We parked it in a low interest account, and we didn't get you the best investment we could. If that constitutes a general breach of fiduciary duty, then what in the heck is the exculpatory clause all about, which everybody concedes you can put in a trust agreement?
I think I understand where you're coming from on this. I think the answer to that is something that maybe has to be struggled with as on a general basis in terms of weighing, you know, the enforceability of the exculpatory clause on one end and whether there is any remaining fiduciary obligation on the other end, which is the very essence of the trust relationship. And I think if you accept the bank's position here, then it reduces our clients to a point that's even less than what an ordinary depositor might have with the bank. It completely eliminates the trust relationship.
But they,
surely our clients...
But they agreed to that. They agreed to that. They wrote, they agreed to the clause.
I think that there's a question about that, Justice Heck, what was agreed to was a clause that... There's some question about its enforceability and some question about what it means. And
well,
I think
Judge Enoch wants to know, what is exculpated if you're right?
If I'm right,
what's exculpated?
I say that...
What's left?
That there is nothing left. And which is my point, that I think that there's that it eliminates the entire fiduciary responsibility.
So what do we do with the statute?
And that's a very good question. That's what I was going to get to. I don't think that this can be evaluated in view of just the statute alone. And here's the reason for that. If you look at that statute, what it says is that, first of all, there must be a settlor, because it uses the term settlor. And I submit that this trust, as a Property Code Chapter 142 trust, has no settlor. And if you construe this, as I think exculpatory provisions generally need to be construed strictly, then it should not apply here. But there's another reason that it should not apply here, and that is that the provision itself says that the trust may not relieve the trustee from any duty, liability, or restriction imposed by this subtitle. Now, my question is, what are those duties, restrictions, and liabilities imposed by that subtitle? Surely not breach of contract. That's not dealt with. And in fact, I will point out, as long as I mention breach of contract, that Frost's motion for summary judgment with respect to the exculpatory clause limits itself only to tort theories of liability. So it contrary to what the petitioners have argued at the outset of their argument, the motion for summary judgment as to the exculpatory clause does not eliminate every cause of action. Nonetheless, I do think that there are duties, liabilities, and restrictions that have been raised as part of our claims that are not encompassed within the trust code. Surely the trust code, if you look at it, does not encompass all common law concepts of breach of fiduciary duty. And in fact, it doesn't. The common law has long recognized.
Doesn't this chapter impose some fiduciary duties?
It imposes the same, but the common law imposes some that are broader than what are contained in the trust code.
What's the point of the statute?
The point of the statute, actually, I think the statute has no point. I think that an exculpatory clause could be inserted subject to the restatement section 222 and public policy. I think an exculpatory clause could be inserted in a trust instrument, a contract, a lease instrument, and they are all the time. The question is whether public policy will permit an exculpatory clause to be so broad that it eviscerates the fiduciary responsibilities and eliminates the trust.
Well, let me make sure I understand. I thought you said that you didn't have so much complaint with bad investment decisions, that was not the focus of your argument, that your argument really starts with the liquidation.
It starts with the liquidation.
And
because
the liquidation resulted in self-dealing and self-profit, that's where you're hanging your hat. So we don't need to go to the bad investment analysis.
We don't. Although I will say that I believe the assessment of the fees was also a separate self-dealing type or profit-making.
But again, it doesn't involve investment decisions.
Correct.
So the exculpatory clause, you would agree, could involve bad investment decisions that would be excused under the clause, or you don't need to go there, according to your argument.
I say that they're not excused for the reasons set out in the restatement in terms of any time you make a profit, that is self-dealing.
No, but exactly, my point exactly. I mean, that my understanding is the only reason you think that the bank profited or self-dealt was as a result of the liquidation and not
correct.
As a result of bad decisions made in investments. And I think that's an important distinction that you appear to be drawing. So I hear the argument going the way of this is going to subject trustees to all sorts of liability for bad investment decisions if we read the exculpatory clause as broadly as you'd like us to, but that's not really the focus of your argument.
It is not.
Well, let me understand this. I thought if you say you were taking this in pieces, they liquidated, and then after they liquidated, they should have invested that day or the very next day, and because they didn't invest for 40-some-odd days, that's a separate decision that you're trying to tag them for. So it is an investment decision.
It is not. We're not attempting to attack that decision. We're attempting to attack that as a consequential damage.
Well, it wasn't consequential to liquidation. They could have liquidated and reinvested the same day or the next day, and you would not have this claim. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So the claim, what you're saying is after the liquidation, they made a bad decision on how to invest the funds after the liquidation. So they aren't really part and parcel of the liquidation.
Well, I disagree. I think that it is part of that, and that they would not have been put in that particular place had it not been for the liquidation.
But I still had to make a decision about what to do with the funds post-liquidation.
Well, and with the predicate assumption that they liquidated them, yes.
But the particular damages you're talking about would not necessarily flow from the liquidation.
I respectfully disagree. I think they do flow from that.
In other words, absent the liquidation, you wouldn't have a claim here.
That's absent the liquidation, there would not be a claim.
It is not. In the briefing, it's not clear to me that people have teed up the issue of who was the trustee at what point in time decisions were made. Frost Bank and Texas Commerce agreed to swap banks, and then this account was liquidated, and either Frost Bank made the decision to liquidate the account or Texas Commerce Bank made the decision to liquidate the account. And who was the trustee at the time it occurred? As I understand it, Texas Commerce Bank now had control of the assets and liquidated it. Is that what happened?
That is true, 3 weeks after this event.
And then you allow the agreements and the laws permit the automatic substitution of trustees. And so do you have a claim against Texas Commerce Bank who was not the trustee at the time they were liquidated? Or do you only get there through your conspiracy theory
We do have a claim. I think probably you're thinking of Frost because it was Texas Commerce Bank that liquidated Linda Grizzle's claim. And to the extent that the banks knew that this was going to happen in advance, that the liquidation was required and that they're making that argument, then I submit that they both are on the hook for that. I would ask that the court take a look at the evidence in connection with these issues on motion for summary judgment. This motion reads like a no-evidence motion. There isn't any evidence submitted in connection with this, and for that reason, we would ask that the court affirm the Court of Appeals' decision to reverse this and remand.
I have yet a question or two, just so I'll be clear. I believe you said, under your view, there really isn't any point to this statute unless it allows exculpation of additional duties that are imposed by statute that are not imposed by the common law.
That's probably true, Your Honor.
And the second,
I guess as an example, I would say the duty to account,
right.
That's probably imposed.
And the second point is that under your view of exculpatory clauses, apart from this statute, what can those clauses exculpate? What decision by the trustee that costs the beneficiary money can the clause exculpate?
I think so long as the decision is not one that can be characterized as self-dealing, or, in my view, under the restatement, bad faith, intentional conduct, and I define self-dealing the way Black's Law Dictionary does, one in which the trustee benefits from the transaction and the beneficiary has a detriment from the transaction, which is precisely what I believe occurred here.
So you can invest all the money in Enron stock right before the bust, and that's fine. You can't decline to put it in an interest-bearing account.
Sure.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Kreider, present rebuttal.
Justice Enoch, you asked about who was the trustee. Frost was no longer the trustee by operation of law. Under the Court of Appeals' erroneous interpretation of what self-dealing is, they said it was failure to properly reinvest, and that was evidence of mishandling. We disagree strongly on that. But Frost did not liquidate the funds. It was no longer trustee by operation of federal law. It had no role in the decision whether to invest or not. Justice Enoch, you also asked about changing banks. I think Justice Baker also had a question about that. The trust instrument does not permit the beneficiary to change her trustees or to choose her trustee. This was a court-approved trust approved by the guardian ad litem as well as Ms. Grizzle, and it expressly contemplated successor trustees by merger. Another thing, there was discussion of this examiner's manual. The summary judgment evidence shows Ms. Grizzle testified she had no objection to the investments when they were made by Frost or those when they were later made by TCB when there was about a 35% increase in her account.
Let me ask you a question. If the Code of Federal Regulations requires the bank to absorb administrative costs for a fund that it reorganizes, would that contemplate cashing out a fund and reinvesting a fund, the expenses associated with that, where you decide that the fund needs to be audited as a result of this cashing out and reinvesting it? Would that money need to be absorbed by the bank under the federal regulation?
I think you would have to look at each individual trust instrument, but under the instrument in question, the expenses of administering the trust properly were are chargeable to the trust. Here, if it were something strictly under the Code of Federal Regulations that has to be absorbed by the bank, they certainly would have to.
Well, if you rely on the federal regulations and statutes to permit the bank to do this, to avoid, which was intentional, but to avoid the bad faith exception to the duties, can you then rely on the trust instrument permitting you to pass through charges that are different than the federal statute that says you've got to absorb the fees? You understand my question? You're saying the federal statute says we do all this, therefore it can't be bad faith, but at the one point where the federal statute says you can't charge the fund for it, you do, and you claim, well, that's because a trust instrument lets us do that. Isn't that somewhat inconsistent?
Well, first of all, the approval process, I mean, this is all Justice Jefferson asked the deference we have to give to the federal government in a different context in this case. We have to give deference to them in terms of the approval of this merger. And it had to be done in accordance with federal law, and we believe it was done. We have objected to any evidence and believe there was not properly evidence before the trial court, about there being audit fees or any other expenses. And those weren't pled as specific elements of damage, nor part of the summary judgment record as we saw it. But, Your Honor, we do believe you are correct that you would have to, there would be certain charges that the banks would have to absorb, and there would be other incidental, normal charges of administering a trust that could be passed along. And I think you'd have to look at each one of those. That's one of the reasons this never would have been proper as a class action.
If the restatement 222 is to be believed, what they've written, it appears that it acknowledges that the trust agreement can absolve trustees of a lot of responsibility and a lot of liability. Primarily focusing on the investment decisions. A trustee just ought not to be liable for making bad investment decisions. And it seems to me that it's pretty well focused that unless it's bad faith or unless it's fraud or gross negligence, you can absolve them of any other negligence. That's in any other activity they do, except the restatement seems to identify the profit to the trustee. I mean, it specifically identifies it. But if the activity results in a profit to the trustee, then to the extent of that profit, there is no exculpation. How would that play here if the bank is supposed to absorb cost to a fund that it liquidates, but by the trust agreement, it passes that through to the trust under this circumstance? Why would that not implicate that part of the restatement?
I think that the type of profiting by a trustee that the legislature has focused on and has said may not be excluded are the trustee using its own property and the trustee loaning money to itself. That is the kind of profiting at the expense of the beneficiary that the legislature is specifically saying you cannot exclude. In this instance, the trustees, the banks, did not profit at the expense of the beneficiary. The merger was wholly independent from the trust relationship. So they didn't enter into the merger in any sense using trust property or loaning money
to
themselves.
Let me ask you a question. If I'm trying to calculate the cost of swapping banks, and so I'm putting my pencil to the paper, I recognize I'm going to cash out these funds. I'm going to have to reinvest the funds. So I'm going to have to do an accounting. And so I calculate what would the cost of the accounting to be. And I say, well, I don't have to worry about absorbing that cost because my trust agreement allows me to pass it through to them. So that's no cost to me, the bank, to do that. Isn't, even though it's not related to the trust, couldn't the argument be made that the bank is free to do all this, but the bank can't do it if it cannot do it without a
merger, was wholly independent from the trust relationship. So they didn't enter into the merger in any sense using trust property or loaning money
themselves.
Let me
ask you a question. If I'm trying to calculate the cost of swapping banks, and so I'm putting my pencil to the paper, I recognize I'm going to cash out these funds. I'm going to have to reinvest the funds. So I'm going to have to do an accounting. And so I calculate what would the cost of the accounting to be. And I say, well, I don't have to worry about absorbing that cost because my trust agreement allows me to pass it through to them. So that's no cost to me, the bank, to do that. Isn't, even though it's not related to the trust, couldn't the argument be made that the bank is free to do all this, but the bank can't do it if it cannot do it without absorbing the costs to these proprietary funds and make the bank calculate it, put as a part of its economic calculation on whether it's going to do a deal with some other bank, the full costs of the merger and the swap, as opposed to the bank not calculating full costs by passing some of the costs to the trust accounts over here.
But we would respectfully submit that would not constitute self-dealing. And importantly, in looking at these accounts, the day before the merger, these accounts had the same value as they did the day after the merger. If you look at the account statement, it was the same amount of money the day before as it was the day after. They didn't incur a loss.
Right.
And that's what the summary judgment record was, and that's what the fact was.
Maybe I'm missing. What was the purpose to liquidate those trusts if there was no change from one day to the next?
Right. It was because for the Code of Federal Regulations provision that we cited that Frost could not hold the common funds of TCB and Texas Commerce likewise could not hold their funds. So they needed to liquidate those because they could not hold them. But there was no cost to the beneficiary. It was the same value in her account the day before as the day after. And importantly, the tax consequence, it was there regardless of the merger. It was the product of market forces in the stock market. So that tax loss was there regardless of the merger, and it would have had to have been recognized at some point. But clearly it was not caused by the merger itself.
What if the summary judgment record showed. Now, I haven't looked at the affidavit, but what if it showed that a common practice is to notify depositors or notify people who have trusts that this merger is about to occur and they can transfer the trust to another account that would not result in liquidation? If that were the normal practice and TCB did not notify them of the right to do that, wouldn't that be some benefit to TCB that they retained the account?
Well, there is nothing in the summary judgment record to that effect, but the federal 12 U.S.C. Section 215 prescribes the type of notice that shall be required for federal banks, and it is cited in our briefing, but it expressly states, Justice O'Neill, that no other action on the part of any court or anyone shall be necessary. So there not only was no requirement for that notice, but no court, no common law ruling by a trial court or respectfully this court could impose additional requirements.
If we can't read that authority that way, that regulation that way, and if there were some practice or some evidence that this could have been done, would that not be some evidence of self-dealing, that by not notifying customers, they were retaining the accounts in their own banks and therefore there was a benefit to them?
Well, they didn't retain the accounts. They, as they merged, the Cullen Frost Corpus Christi Bank took over all the accounts of Texas Commerce, and Texas Commerce took over all of the Dallas.
At my point exactly. I mean, if the people who have the trust had moved it to another Frost branch bank, that wouldn't have happened. It moved into TCB's column as a result of not notifying that they had the option to move it. And I guess, my question is, if there's some, assuming with me that it could have been done and that it often is done, that depositors are given this option to change their account, then would that not be some evidence of benefits TCB from...
I would respectfully say it would not, and I think that,
why would it not if it allows them to retain the account?
It would not. You may call it benefit. It would certainly not be self-dealing, and self-dealing as prescribed by the legislature is, we believe, limited to, you know, dealing in loaning money to yourself and buying and selling property for yourself as provided in Sections 113.
Well, why would not holding onto an account be having property for yourself?
Well, they didn't hold on to the account, so that actually would have been is the antithesis of self-dealing. They transferred the account. Keeping the account, I don't see would be self-dealing at all.
You said when you first stood up that on this topic that they could not have transferred the trust to a different Frost branch. Why not?
The trust instrument, Your Honor, does not provide for the beneficiary to be able to change her trustees. There is a provision.
But the settlor could have.
Settlor could have.
So she'd been notified. She could have gone to the court and said, I want to move my account from this branch of Frost Bank to another branch.
On the other hand, under federal statute 12 U.S.C. 215E, there is no notice requirement. And, in fact, it expressly says in that statute that upon the merger, that the successor bank will succeed to all rights, not just as a trust, but leases, all contracts, everything, without any court approval or otherwise.
No, I'm just saying, pre-merger, Frost Bank could have sent out notice to its trust accounts saying, we're about to merge and this may have tax consequences or other consequences, and you have the option of moving your trust account to another branch of Frost Bank.
I don't know whether they would have had that option. It's certainly nothing. Justice O'Neill asked also whether that was common practice. It's certainly the only practice of which I'm aware is to follow the federal statute.
No federal statute would have precluded a pre-merger notice or transferring the account.
I do not know of anything in federal statute that would have precluded that. I certainly know that if a bank follows, as these two banks did, the federal requirements, that notice requirement cannot be second-guessed by any other court. They have followed federal law for the merger of federal banks and national banks, and in no court can prescribe other requirements, whether it's notice or otherwise. So we think that they fully complied with the federal law.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first clause.
All right.